Here we are with part two of Rip Canal. Man, first one was fantastic. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. I myself listened to it a couple times, and I've heard from many people who loved his military stories, and man, God, the guy's just full of wisdom. He's done everything. And now this episode, we get really in-depth into his current business, which is his drug rehabilitation clinic. And we talk a lot about the misunderstandings of what his clinic does. And, you know, many people call it a methadone clinic, and he does not like that term at all. You know, we got really in-depth into drug addiction, and I am in no way an expert on anything, but definitely not drug addiction. I've seen it in my life plenty of times, and I'm sure all of you have too. I mean, everybody has seen someone struggle with the addiction of drugs, narcotics. And so this, I felt like, was very important to talk about and to maybe spread a better understanding so that we can understand people who struggle with this. And I'm so excited for you guys to listen to what he has to say. I loved it. I enjoyed it so much. Let's get going. All right, let's do it. All right. So we left off with you talking about how you never want to go back to where you came from. Okay. So you talked a little bit about with the taxes, how you got into the medical industry. So let's go back to that.
How I really got into the medical field is that here I am, I'm in the law office, and the guy next door to me was a pharmacist, and he used to own a pharmacy, and he was a pharmacist for this little clinic. Mm-hmm. He had like 49 patients in this small little clinic. And so he came to me, and he owed the IRS about $65,000.
Now, is that a lot in this great scheme of like people you worked with?
It was a lot in his, because he had no money.
Right.
Because he had just about, the pharmacy had almost bankrupted him. Right. And the thing that he had was payroll taxes, which he didn't pay. And so the IRS doesn't look favorably on that.
Right.
Because they think it's their money, and technically it is.
Right.
So we went, and I represented him for the IRS, and we got that $65,000 reduced down to $14,000.
Wow.
And so he thought at that time, anytime that you are successful for a client, they think you walk on
right. Hung the moon.
On water. Work mouth. I start stuttering sometimes. but then he said, well, Rip, he said, I've got this clinic I work at. This doctor is in Atlanta, and I think he could sell this clinic. Would you see if you can negotiate it for me to buy it?
So for him to buy it.
Yeah, for him to buy it. So for an hourly rate, you know, I did that, and it took me almost a year and a half to negotiate the sale of the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
so that was going to be his second clinic.
Pardon me?
That was going to be his second clinic?
No, it's going to be his. He was the only employee at this clinic.
Oh, okay. I got you. Okay.
And he wanted to become the owner.
Okay. Okay.
And so after about a year and a half, we come to the agreement, and I tell him that here it is. Here's the figure. It's below what you wanted, and this would be great.
Right.
A great purchase for you. And then he said, Rip, he said, that's absolutely fantastic. I got a problem. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, I don't have any money.
Oh.
And I got bad credit. And I
How's he planning on buying a clinic then?
Well, he didn't think that the doctor would sell it.
But he had you do it anyways.
Next question. Where's my fee coming from?
Right.
Well, then he says, well, let's become partners.
Mm.
Oh, man, I tell you, it's like, you know.
I'm sure I want to be partners with a guy that has no money and bad credit.
But he had the knowledge of how the clinic worked. And he had a pharmacy license. And, you know, and he had been in that business, and I had not a clue. The only thing I knew is that what I had learned during a 18-month research into their finances and looking at the company and seeing how they did things and what they did. And it, I really got interested in it.
But you have to have a pretty good idea of the business by looking into it that way, right?
Oh, I did. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew I had a lot of money tied up in a fee. And at that time, the court had just appointed me to be a administrator over an estate where a guy had committed suicide. And it was a mobile home company. And sitting there in my office late one night, and I didn't hear any voice or anything like that. It's just a feeling that came over me and said, this is what you need to do. You need to buy that clinic. You need to go into that business. And
so that clinic that you bought, it was in Atlanta?
Nope.
Where is it?
It was in Rossville.
So that's the clinic that
I own now, but it was on Lake Avenue. It was a small little clinic. It had really 48 patients, I think it was. Wow. 48 or 49. I think it was 48 patients. And through a leap of faith, I went into the business and initially went, the guy that was the pharmacist talked me into coming in and partners with him. And he would, he knew how it would go and how to run it. And through, like I said, blind faith, I just felt like this was something where I was drawn to.
So you feel really drawn to it. Is that like, did you have a history of addiction or any of that sort? Because it's an addiction clinic, correct?
Right.
It's addiction recovery.
The only thing I had was on the outskirts of seeing a father being an addict, seeing a uncle being an alcoholic and then getting into recovery, seeing, other addictions that were not only in my family, but in friends. And for my part, it was just such an interesting feel.
Right.
And so I went back to, I went to the University of Georgia, and I really choked when I have to say that. But I went down to the Southeastern School of Alcohol and Drug Addiction. And so I went to school, I guess, 3 or 4 different classes. I went to seminars and classes in from San Francisco to St. Louis to Orlando and learning everything that I could about addiction.
Were those things mandatory, or was that just like something you take upon yourself?
Well, yeah, if you wanted to get certified, yeah, because I bought the clinic in 98. Right. So you can imagine it's 31 years ago.
Right.
And at that time, pain pill addiction really hadn't came into full force to our society. Some of it was there, but you get around 2001, 2002, you had a spike of pill mills and pain clinics going everywhere.
Is that the only type of addiction that you treat at that facility or at that clinic?
Yeah, there are other co-coordinating addictions you could be a meth addict and an alcoholic. You could be a substance use disorder, an opiate use disorder patient, being addicted to pain pills, and also be addicted to benzodiazepines, which are Xanaxes and Valiums, or alcohol.
I'm not a drug addict, but I know people who are, and those people that I know, it isn't like they only do meth or they only do, certain things. It's like they're just looking for a high a lot of times, correct? Like it isn't like they'll do basically anything when they're suffering from that, right? Is that?
Oh yeah.
I mean, they're just looking for a high.
I mean, I posted something on Facebook just recently that said, a person that has an addiction, it's not saying no once a day, because if you are an active addiction, you are wanting something every minute.
Right.
So you are saying no 1,440 times a day.
Right.
of saying, I don't want to do this. And the people usually ask me, what is the worst drug that you would, that is to come off of? What would you think there, Mr.
The
Cup?
Worst drug to come off of, man.
Yeah, the hardest drug to come off of.
I'm not a big, I don't even like taking ibuprofen. I'm not big on stuff like that. Right. So I don't know. I mean, I have no guess.
The most
honestly.
Difficult drug.
Tobacco?
Is nicotine.
Really?
Yep.
I've always heard like it's worse than cocaine or,
it is. I mean, I've had a patient and friend of mine was standing there one time and he said, Rip, he said, I'll tell you, I actively use heroin every day for 17 years of my life.
Wow.
And it was so much easier coming off of heroin than what it is.
But could that not be because nicotine's much more accessible and is legally accessible?
No. Nicotine is a physically addicting drug and a psychologically addicting drug.
What is the difference? What do you mean?
A physically addicted drug means that when you come off of it, you're going to have some physical withdrawals. Mostly alcohol.
Right.
With like DTs, alcohol. With opiates sometimes, when you get into withdrawals, it's a physically addicting drug.
Sweating, stuff like that.
Yep. And then once that you have it, once you feel the mu receptors in the brain, then you are totally good. But a psychologically addicting drug is when I go to sleep and I dream about smoking a cigarette. And I would get ready to put a cigarette in my mouth and light it,
mm-hmm.
and absolutely wake up. The snap of a finger, just right. kind of wake up. What am I doing? And there's sometimes if you ever have been a smoker and then you quit smoking, the smell of smoke is offensive. I hate going in and out the doors of the mall.
Oh, yeah.
You pass by all the smokers, and someone that had just thrown a cigarette out, and they walk up next to you.
Mm-hmm. What's funny is they can't smell it, but you can smell it. Like, what's funny is my dad, growing up, he smoked. I don't think he smokes anymore, but I love that smell. Like, I know that's so silly, but maybe it's because I was a child growing up around it or what, but like his pillow smelled.
Did you ever smoke?
No.
That may be the difference.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I've never smoked. So I almost like that smell. Maybe it's because the relation between my dad and the smell in my, psychologically, I'm like, this means my dad basically. But, but like now growing up, people who around me who smoke, they can't smell it. They have no idea it's there. They smoke in their car. They get in. You're like, oh God, it smells terrible in here. They have no idea.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people this day and time that do not smoke.
Oh,
and what they did when I was a kid.
Smoking is down tremendously. It's like only 13% of the population smokes now. But there's also, I'd say back whenever you were younger, there was ads about it being cool. You know,
doctors would prescribe smoking cigarettes to lose weight.
Right. And now there's ads about it killing people and what it does to your lungs.
I'm a prime example. I wish that I had never smoked. And if I ever, ever smoke a cigarette again, one would be too many and 1,000 would not be enough.
Really?
Because, I would,
You think you would savor that moment? I mean,
I'd start smoking again in a New York minute.
Really?
That's what I said. If I smoked that one,
you'd be
the next 1,000 wouldn't be enough for me.
Wow. So let me ask you this. We're talking about smoking necessarily, but really you're referring to nicotine, which isn't just smoking. So what is your take on vapes? Those are like the new big thing.
Oh man, I tell you what, I hate them. I hate them. If young people could see what that, the vapor,
right,
is wet.
It's water.
You hear what I'm saying? It's wet.
Right.
Fog is wet. When you drown, what do? You get lungs in your...
You get water in your lungs.
You get water in your lungs, and they get wet and do not can't absorb oxygen.
Right.
And you die. So what you're doing is that you are putting water vapors in your lungs. And, you know, and it all depends on how strong your lungs are. You know, those water vapors have caused things called popcorn lung.
Well, see, it's crazy to me. Because, like, right now, for example, right now, people are talking about the COVID vaccine. Well, I'm not going to get it because I don't know the long-term effects. I don't, I'm not going to get it because I don't know what it's going to do to me in such and such time. But yet you're willing to take up a vape pen and you're willing to vape. And do you know the long-term effects of that?
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand how people are willing to do something. And hey, I'm not knocking you if you vape, more power to you, whatever. Everybody has their own drug of choice per se. You know, I'm sure I have mine, you know, but at the same time, you don't know what that's going to do to you in 10 years or 15. Well, people, just same thing for smoking. People didn't know back then what they know now, what it's doing to them now.
Oh yeah, it was such a big part of our economy, from tobacco farms to, you know, to manufacturing facilities. But the thing that, the reason why, and I'm trying to stumble here because I want to say this correctly.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why a lot of people get into drugs, a reason why a lot of people start smoking or use vaping or drinking,
mm-hmm,
or anything to excess, they, if they had had the education and knowledge prior to doing that heroin,
mm-hmm,
drinking that scotch,
oh, of course,
smoking that Camel cigarette,
well, yeah.
And,
well, they say hindsight's 20/20.
Well, you know, it also, you know, people should be able to learn from people.
Right.
Listen, you know, this is not going to happen to me, but, you know, you take teenagers, and you and I have been around a lot of teenagers in the past few years.
Absolutely.
And most of them think they're 10 foot tall and bulletproof.
Well, you can't stop them from vaping half the time.
Most of them, yes. Lord knows we tried to stop them.
Bacon. Yes.
And, you know, even if you were to give them a class and said, here it is, which we have done, and, you know, here's the harmful effects of vaping, here's the harmful effects of meth, but yet something draws them back to there. And, well, there are certain percentages going to say, you know, I am not going to, it's not going to affect me.
Right.
I think that overall, you know, we need to continue to educate our kids. When I started wearing a seatbelt, how did I start wearing a seatbelt? Because I've got kids sitting in the back seat. Dad, do you know at school they said that you need to put a seatbelt on to be safe? Did you know that, Dad?
Right.
Okay, I'll do it. And that's how I started wearing seatbelts, because they educated my kids to pressure me into.
You could absolutely look at it. I don't know the statistics, but I know that, you know, I'd like to see the statistics on, like, DARE came into my school. You know, DARE came into most people's schools and said, smoking is bad.
Yep.
And that's probably a huge reason why my generation does not smoke.
And, you know, and my kids again said, I lit up. They said, Dad, do you know that smoking causes you to have lung cancer?
Yep.
Do you know that it causes me to have secondhand smoke? Cough, cough, cough.
Right.
And, you know, do you need to do that in the house, Dad? And eventually, you know, you end up quitting smoking.
Right.
You know, and if you were to educate at one time, and I remember, and it stopped it really quick. They started having sex education,
mm-hmm,
in school. Well, my gosh, there were so many parents that protested about that. And, you know, and if they, I would rather for them to learn it at school than in the bathroom.
Well,
and
yeah, what you say, that's the parents' responsibility.
Also, you take the parent says, well, it should be a church's responsibility. And church says, well, it should be a school's responsibility. And church school says, it should be a parent's responsibility.
Yes.
So, you know, you've got, you know, someone has got to step up and it's got to be the parent. But you get into this business and you start seeing patients coming in and you're seeing patients that are in withdrawals and you see what happens to a patient when they can get the proper medication. Because a lot of people that are pain pill addicts, you know, they take a pain pill for the first time and said, hey, this is what it feels like to be normal.
Right.
And, you know, and they treat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't self-medicate yourself. And so instead of going to the doctor, but the pain pills on the street today, they come from doctors. They come from pharmacies.
Right.
You don't grow a pain pill out in your backyard like you can pot. But, you know, and I think regulating that, we've seen a lot of success there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when that person comes into our clinic and they've got that pain pill addiction, the one thing they want to be, normal.
Absolutely.
That's exactly the one question you ask when we do an intake. What do you want out of this program?
Right.
What do you want to accomplish? 95% will tell you, I want to feel normal like I did when I was 15.
So you talk about the intake. Say I'm a drug addict and I walk into your clinic. What is the process?
Well, first of all, there are certain criteria that you have to meet.
Okay.
You have to have had a certain time of addiction.
Like being an addict for so long?
Yeah.
Okay.
You've got to have certain criteria that you have to meet in order to qualify. Then, you know, after you do a psychosocial, then you've got a drug test to take. And then at that point in time, we see what's on board.
What do you mean?
See what's on board.
Oh, like what you tested positive for?
Yeah. Well, what do you have in your system?
Right. Okay.
So, you know, if you've got opiates in your system, and I mean, we've had people, and it's not uncommon, you test someone, they'd be positive for opiates, Oxycontin, benzodiazepines, mm-hmm. Barbiturates, and marijuana.
So someone can't come in sober and get treated.
Well, yeah.
With nothing in their system. Does that make sense?
Well, what it is that if we're going to give you any medication at all, and there sometimes we won't give you any medication,
mm-hmm.
But if you come in, you come into the clinic,
right?
And you said, well, when's the last time you used, Tuck? And he said, well, I just shot up a half a gram 45 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
That does not tell me anything except that you are not to get any medications, anything that we get from your vitals, because we're going to give you a physical.
Okay.
Now, we're going to test you for the venereal disease. We're going to test you for TB. And there's a move on in our state now to start testing for hepatitis C. We did do that at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they go through their physical, they get all their paperwork done, they get all of the consents signed, because they have to consent for us to treat them.
Right.
And then they will see our doctor. And then the doctor examines them after they've had their physical.
Mm-hmm.
And because at that time, he's going to know what the blood pressure is and what the heart rate is and everything. And if they're actively using at that time, then, you know.
You can tell by the vitals.
It's not going to give you a clear picture as to who Tuck is. And so you come back, you don't use for 24 hours. You're going to be a little edgy. You're going to be going into withdrawals. And then at that point in time, we can help you. And then we decide when you come in, you know, what do you want to get out of treatment? You know, do you want to do this in 30 days in detox and you're on your way and you think you can handle it? Or is this a 180-day deal? Or, you know, do you think that you need to get into treatment and see how you are and then, you know, and back down onto your onto any dosage from a medical standpoint?
So you're trying to, so you want to know what they want to get out of treatment.
Right.
And yeah, so it's not like the same mainstream treatment for every person that walks in.
Oh gosh, that's so true. I mean, we have people bringing Johnny in for treatment. Listen, my son's here and I want him to get treated. I want him to get well right now.
Right.
Well, you know what? The parent may want it.
Right.
Maybe Johnny doesn't.
Johnny's got to want it.
And if Johnny doesn't want it, it's useless for him even being there.
Absolutely.
And so he has got to want it, just like you stop smoking. You've got to want to be a non-smoker more than you want to smoke. It just comes down to being that simple.
So people tend to think that you're just giving them drugs in there, but that's not the case. Like,
oh no, I mean the most we give them more counseling.
Right.
Then we give them any medication. And you know, and medication and nobody leaves there high or blitz or anything like that. I mean, and we have had medical doctors that are patients, and we've had lawyers that are patients. We have principals that are patients, school teachers, truck drivers, electricians, CPAs, homeless people, bricklayers, UPS drivers, and you know, I promise you, it is a non-discriminatory disease.
No, absolutely. I want people to understand that people aren't, a drug addict isn't walking in and just getting drugs, right? They're being treated psychologically, I guess. They're receiving therapy, right? But, and then what's the difference? What I'm going to say is, what's the difference in, say I'm a meth addict? What's the difference in me going and doing meth and then getting methadone? Or like, that's just one drug you prescribe, right? There's multitude of drugs that a person can get.
We do describe methadone, and we prescribe buprenorphine, which is Subutex, and if a person, you know, a person is going to, in our program, you have to make a decision in your life.
Right.
Do you want to give up illicit drugs? Because you will not stay in our program and use illicit drugs and our medication while you're doing it.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, and you've got to make that choice. But the one thing that we do that is not done, and I wish that everyone would do it, but say John Doe comes in the clinic and he is getting from Dr. Jane Rowe his prescription for pain pills, or he's at a pain clinic, then he's using his medications up too quickly. What we would do is we would contact Dr. Rowe and say, all right, John Doe is now our patient. He is and John Doe has to give us permission to do that.
Right.
And he is in our treatment program now, so he's not going to be getting any more prescriptions from you.
Right.
And there's a commitment that he makes. There is an alert that we give to the other physician that, you know, that now he's an addict.
Does that like tag them on their medical files as an addict? So like, is it possible for other doctors to see that they're an addict as well? Does that make sense? I don't know if that's a thing.
Well, there is a registry,
right?
A pharmacy's registry in Tennessee and Georgia, and doctors can say your doctor, you can go to that physician And they're supposed to do this if they, I think, three times they give opiates out. They have to check the registry. And they could just type your name in and your social security number, and it will show them everywhere you've gotten a prescription fill and who filled it.
Right.
So if you are doctor shopping, your doctor is going to be able to tell that if he is.
Right.
If he's checking that.
Do most doctors check that when prescribing?
I don't know most doctors.
Okay. That's a good answer.
I don't know how to ask that. I guess I have to ask a doctor then. I was just curious.
I know of doctors that have done that.
But it would probably only be with somebody who have repeatedly tried to get drugs from them. Would you say?
Well, you would.
Like, you're not checking every person in the database every time you ever prescribe anything.
Right.
Right.
And you know people that are going to play games with you. We have patients come in and try to play games with us. We've been in the business now. You know, our clinic started in 1989. We're one of the oldest clinics in the state.
Wow.
And our clinic, we have been really on the forefront of doing things the right way. You know, our pharmacy license is number one.
What does that mean?
We were the first clinic in the state to have a pharmacy license.
Wow. Okay.
And we were the first clinic in the state to become accredited.
Were you the first clinic in this area? Like
in the state of Georgia.
You're the first clinic in the state of Georgia. How many clinics?
So see, when I first purchased the clinic in 1989, there were only 14 clinics in the state of Georgia. But the clinic in Macon, the clinic in Savannah, the clinic in two clinics in Atlanta, Southside and Grady Hospital, four of those clinics were state owned.
Okay. So you're the first privately owned.
So there were 10 privately owned clinics in the entire state. So the state, they could not run a clinic legally. So they had to get out of the clinic business. Okay. And so now there's been just a flood of people opening up clinics in the state. Now we have over 70.
Well, I was reading an article as I was doing my research about how they were passing legislation to try to, they basically put a stop on clinics opening. It was like in 2017, I think. And you were in it. That's why I saw it. Right. And you said you were for that legislation, that you agreed to that.
I was that it, Jeff Mullis did a tremendous service for North Georgia and the state of Georgia as a senator that proposed that legislation, got it through. Now, our association in Atlanta, the Opiate Treatment Providers of Georgia, that was an association we started when all of the owners, we could meet in a conference room. And now, you know, it's fairly large. And a very important organization.
Okay, so hearing that name, is that who kind of holds the standard for clinics?
They are the ones that we try to set standards, the best practice standards, and they are the conduit to the state.
Okay.
The state, instead of the state having to talk to 70 people, they can work through the association, and the associations can disseminate the information. We also have, you know, educational classes, and it's really a special organization to me because not only was, you know, I'm one of the charter members of it, but there were three people that that were instrumental. It was a guy by the name of Ned Etherington. And a lady by the name of Penny Hall, and both of them were in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And Ned has a son named Brooke. Penny has a daughter named Stacy. And with Courtney and my son Jonathan, they are all good friends, and they're doing what their parents did before them in the association.
Oh, cool.
It's just a second generation.
That's great. Yeah.
So it's so cool to see that.
So your son, what is he, works with you or for you?
No,
or
how wait, did that role he work? He used to have a clinic, and we used to be partners, but he decided that he would rather go into the medical sales business.
Okay.
A little company that we started years ago that I shouldn't even mention I was even part of it, but it was just little teeny tiny little bottle company, and he has turned it into what it is now. It's, you know, it's there in Fort Oglethorpe with MedStat.
Okay.
And he supplies, you know, medical equipment, pharmacy bottles and medical equipment to
so that's right. He's right there where the old gymnastics place was.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you,
well, it's a beautiful facility. I've never been in there, but it's beautiful from the outside.
Well, he had a good imagination, mm-hmm, and a good vision.
So I want to get back to your clinic. Good. And so I just want people to have a good understanding of what it's about and how you help people. And so there's a good bit of, you know, psychological evaluation that goes on, and there's counseling. And not
our counselors, we have more certified counselors at our clinic than at any clinic in the state of Georgia.
That's fantastic.
That is, I mean, I am so proud of, well, and these people have got years of experience.
Right. Well, years. I like that because, I mean, I've never been a drug addict, like I said, but I understand that there's a huge, like, the main foundation of, I think, in my opinion, being an addict is psychological. There's so much going on in that person's head, and that has to be evaluated to some extent. And so, you know, and I want people to also understand, like you said, not everyone goes on there to receive dosages of medication.
Oh yeah. And they are to reduce their usage also. But, you know, if you do not understand what took you there in your addiction to start with,
right,
you can quit, but what took you there the first time will take you back.
Absolutely.
So you've got to understand, why did I start using?
Right.
You know, and that, you know, and, you know, and once that you can tackle that, well, you know, the rest of it is
easier said than done. I'm sure. Absolutely.
Well, I totally have so much respect for people in recovery, mm-hmm, especially this time of year, because this time of year is when depression sets in. And one of the things that triggers depression is sugar, sweets.
It triggers depression.
Yeah.
How is that?
I just read an article about that.
Really?
Yes. I mean, it was just really, and it's especially germane about depression in the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
I know one a couple of days ago that all of the sweets that we eat and all the sugar, it triggers the brain into a depressive state.
Well, they say that, isn't it true that sugar stimulates the same part of the brain that I think cocaine stimulates or something along those lines, where it's similarly addictive?
Yes and no. Sugar gives you a rush.
Right.
Very short-lived rush.
Sugar high.
And yeah. Whereas cocaine is...
Well, I'm not saying it's as powerful.
But see, cocaine and sugar would be both psychologically addicting drugs. I mean, it's... Cocaine is not a physically addicting drug.
I mean, I can't say I haven't dreamed about eating Little Debbie, so I'm not going to say you're wrong.
I'll get that article for you. Say, here, I think I'm going to eat a gumdrop and be a little depressed today.
But so you talk about this time of year, but more so, have you seen an increase or a decrease of clientele coming in your clinic from based on COVID, or this time of year when people are supposed to stay home, are supposed, you know, how has that affected clients?
Well, we have a really strict COVID policy. You're screened prior to even stepping in the door. Then you have to have a mask on the entire time you're there.
Mm-hmm.
All of our people have PPE, and so you know we. You know,
but psychologically, how has it affected people? I mean, have you seen the difference in people? Like, I'm sure a lot of addicts suffer from depression. You know, I suffer from depression, and it's very easy when I get by myself for a long period of time, which maybe they're
up on that pity pot.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy for you to sit here and say, nobody cares about me.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks about me. I'm this, I'm that, you know? And so I'm sure it's extremely easy to slip back into that place you were.
And suicide is
through the roof.
The highest.
Absolutely.
During depression. Because just like I am not useful to anyone.
Right.
Why am I even here? I make everybody else happier. And that is in itself a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be a person that has a disease of addiction. And, you know, addiction, it's, you know, the DSM 5 now, is, you know, that refers to, addiction now is if you're addicted to opiates, it's a opiate use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol is alcohol use disorder. Chemical use disorder, substance abuse disorder.
Right.
And, you know, and that does sound better than addict.
Right.
You know, and addict has got its own, you know, connotation to it. And, you know, and the one thing I've noticed over the past 20 years is that people embrace their addiction and they criticize the other addiction.
What do you mean?
I've had people sitting in my office before. I had a father there one time and his daughter was just going into withdrawals.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting there. Well, I tell you right now, if she just say no, then you know, that's all it takes. She could quit this if she just said no.
And he goes outside and smokes a cigarette.
And I'm sitting there, I'm looking, he's got a pack of cigarettes in his pocket.
Yep.
I said, okay, why don't you quit those? He said, well, I could if I wanted to.
Absolutely.
I said, well, yeah, you know, I thought that too. I quit 4 times in one day. And, but he would not totally see to start with that his cigarette addiction, it will be harder for him to stop than what his daughter is going through.
Right.
Well, his daughter ultimately ended up being an extremely good patient. And it took her probably 5 or 6 years to detox out of the clinic and become totally drug-free.
How does that work in the aspect of, you talk about the patients and you ask them what they want or what they're looking to gain, who decides if they receive medication and when you dose down, you know, things along, like, is it an agreement between the therapist and the patient or the therapist says, hey, today we're going to step you down 5 milligrams or the patient says, I'm ready to step down. You know, how does that work?
Well, first of all, it's a patient's treatment. It's not the nurse's treatment. It's not the counselor's treatment, not even the doctor's treatment. It's, you know, how can we work together to accomplish a goal?
Mm-hmm.
And if you would, you know, hold your hands up with your thumbs touching each other and take your forefingers and make it into a triangle,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, that is the way we detox people, is that, you know, that the line going up and down is the time, and the line going across is the amount. So, you know, as you decrease medication into a patient, then at that point in time, now you are chemically telling that person, I'm getting really technical here, and I'm trying.
No, that's okay.
I try not to.
But, no, it's okay.
But you try to regulate the serotonin, the dopamine, endorphins
right.
that you're chemically telling the brain to produce.
Right.
And as you are dropping that dosage down, then your brain can produce a small amount of those chemicals on their own.
Right.
Because when they started using drugs, they put themselves in a wheelchair, because as they chemically tow their brain as to how to make them feel.
So their brain stops producing
and
those chemicals.
So the brain acts as a muscle, just relied on those chemicals.
Right.
Whenever I want to operate, I get a shot of chemical to tell me to do it. And if I don't have my food, then I'll start making them go into withdrawals and they give me something.
Right.
And so so as they're going down, the chemical can produce 5%. And then as the brain produces that 5% itself of chemicals,
mm-hmm.
then it gets stronger and stronger, and it produces that 5% really well. And so as you go down, it's a longer amount of time before you go down again.
So the more you lessen the dosage, the longer between the lessening it gets. Basically.
Exactly.
Okay.
You said it much better than I did. And so then when that patient has got to be talking to their counselor, and these counselors are, you know, college graduates. They are certified
mm-hmm.
in alcohol and addiction counseling. So
right.
they, you know, there is nothing that you're going to tell them that
they haven't heard before, right?
And there is nothing that you will tell them that they can repeat without your permission.
Absolutely.
We are operated under a federal confidentiality law, which is more strict than an attorney client. It's more strict than a preacher center, and it's more strict than a doctor patient relationship.
Wow.
Because we could be criminally liable, and we could be held civilly.
Okay. So you talk about how when a person's using drugs, their brain begins or quits making or producing those chemicals that it needs. And so by providing them with the dosages, it helps their brain to slowly begin to produce those again.
Yeah, but when you become addicted, you rewire your brain. You could come out of an addiction with somewhat of a different personality.
Oh, okay. I've seen that before. Absolutely. I've seen that before. But what I was getting at was what would happen if that person did not receive that dosage? So say I'm an addict for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
My brain is now dependent upon that drug
mm-hmm.
to produce those chemicals. And then I stop because I want to get clean. Boom, cold turkey.
Oh, yeah. We've had people do that before. And it's just going to withdrawals.
But your brain will eventually begin to do it. It's just a much harder process.
Yeah, but yes. It you can do it. If you want to white knuckle recovery, mm-hmm. you can do it.
It'll take longer. I mean, it'll be a long time before your brain's producing those chemicals.
Every person's different.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
But I will tell you that at that point in time, you don't resolve of what took you there.
Oh, I'm sure, but through counseling, you still can. So, if I've been an addict for 5-10 years, and I come into your clinic and I say I don't want to do medication, but I want to do counseling.
Yeah,
that's still possible.
Oh yeah,
and so you can still reach the core of your problem. It's just going to be a lot more of a difficult
path. A matter of fact, when a person comes into our clinic and they taper off, then we give them 1 year of free counseling.
Really?
Yes. And
wow, that's fantastic.
And that, you know, it's important to us that they don't relapse.
Of course.
Because the longer they go without relapsing, I mean, I would love to have turned my clinic into a sleep apnea center or a daycare so we healed addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not going to happen, but you know, you the only difference that you and I are not on the other side of that desk at our clinic is just by the grace of God.
Oh, absolutely. It's just, absolutely.
And we all have addictions. Every one of us has our own little challenge. It would be amazing how many, if you just look, see how many addiction services are offered for anything you can imagine.
Right.
You know,
I mean, what was I going to go with next? This is the way my brain works is I always go to a preventative mindset. So the clinic is kind of for, you've already become an addict. And I guess we talked about it earlier is kind of educating the youth. That's always been everyone's best bet to prevent things like smoking and wearing your seatbelt. We talked about that earlier, but what is there a preventative way to help reduce the amount of drug use or drug addicts?
How did we reduce the seatbelts and the cigarettes?
So go back to that. So it's educating the youth.
If you educate, it is. I have never had a patient didn't tell me if I knew then what I know now.
Right.
I'd never taken the first pain pill.
Right.
They were not educated to what it does. They were not educated as to how it happens. But if we were to educate the young person that, you know, here is what is out there today. It's man-made. It's going, and it is harmful. And, you know, and these things you don't touch. You know, it's just, but, you know, it's the same class you have with sex education. You got the parents are going to say, well, I do not want my children to learn anything about drugs. Do you know where kids learn about drugs?
No.
At home.
Oh, seeing their parents?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I had my wife, years ago, she's a hairdresser.
Mm-hmm.
And she was doing this lady's hair. And, you know, you sit there and you're getting a perm. And, you know, and she's rolling her hair up and you hand them a paper and they just roll it back up and you hand them another one. And this little girl sitting there said, do you know what? My daddy used to roll up his cigarettes in those papers. How do you unring a bell?
Yep.
And so, but that child sees that.
Right.
That becomes a normal.
It's acceptable to them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a normal within my house. Everything goes, it's fine. It's the same thing of someone sitting at home with a big bowl of popcorn and eating all the time with the children. That's the normal.
Well, that's one thing I worry about with my daughter is like, I'm a snacker and I'm a big guy. I'm not the first one to admit that I like sweets.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I sit at home or I'll be sitting on the couch and I'm going to get me something to snack on. I'll go get me a piece of chocolate or whatever. And now I see her. Dad, I want. Can I try that? Can I have that? And, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, my stepdad told me one thing is what is tolerated by one generation is accepted by the other.
You're exactly right.
And I think that's, you know, a lot of where our country's at right now. Or, you know, what is tolerated by one generation is normal to the other or accepted by the other. And that's absolutely true. You know what? But it could also go the other way in the aspect of, you know, for me, I have seen people use drugs and I saw the terrible things it did to them. And I say, I'm never going to do that. You know, like for you know, you had you a drink the other night, but then you told me your dad was an alcoholic. For me, that was surprising to me because most people who I know whose fathers or mothers or whatever were alcoholics, they won't touch it.
Right. But they also can be more aware of where I'm going with it too.
Right. I'm not saying anything bad about you doing it.
No, I'm not apologizing. It's just that you're more aware of the weaknesses you've got.
Right.
You know, I think that there are so many things that we see, that we accept, and that we lose ourselves, if that makes any sense. I mean, when you take religion out of school, then that's something I just never understood. Because I promise you, on Fridays when it comes test time, there's more praying going on at school than you could ever imagine.
That's absolutely true.
And, you know,
Lord, I'll study for the next one if you let me pass this.
No, yeah. Lord, just work with me on this.
Let me get a C. It's all I'm asking for.
And you know, and you see that these boys that we coach, good kids. And so many of them reminds me of me.
Oh, I've seen myself in so many of them.
Oh, yeah. And that's the reason why my heart goes out to them. And if I could ever step up to do anything to keep a kid going down the path of not only addiction, but, you know, of doing things that's not right. There's one thing I totally try to, not only to my kids, but even to the patients and people I deal with, is, you know, right is right, even if everyone is against it. And wrong is wrong, even if everybody is for it.
Absolutely. I get that.
And that is, you know, those are the things that a lot of times just kids are not taught.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I always like observing this. Like, I like to see a kid come in his freshman year. And maybe this is a kid that doesn't have a good home life, doesn't have a dad in his home. And, for example, that was me, you know. And then to see the transition from freshman to sophomore to junior to senior, and not just see maturity, but to see him after he's been around a group of men. And I'm not saying I'm the best guy in the world. I'm not saying that at all. But we every day try to, hey, that's wrong, that's right, that's wrong, that's right. You know, let's try to mold these into good men and men of character. And then you see them their senior year and you go, it's worked. I see the difference in this kid. And I know that when he gets out of this school, he's not going to be what I was worried about his freshman year. You know, and I can see character, I can see development, and that's what makes coaching so fulfilling.
I agree. And I see that you're a wonderful role model. I mean, you are not far removed from their age, but yet you demand attention, you demand courtesy, and you demand things from those kids that nobody else has ever demanded before.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And I respect you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate
and we
that.
Both work for one hell of a guy.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, Bo Campbell, you know, his parents, they did something right when they did what he and Jason.
Yeah. And, well, that's the thing is, you know, him and Jason, they were that for me. You know, my dad and I, we didn't have a good relationship at that time. You know, we didn't talk much and it was just me and my mom in the house. And so I did, you know, it was yes, sir, no, sir. It was, you know, I remember Jason got an email for me goofing off in class, about me goofing off in class. And he's like, be there, be here. And I think it was like 5 a.m. And he punished me, you know, with running, up downs, push-ups, physical punishment, to the point where I said, I'm never going to get in trouble in class again. And from that point, it was like, okay, this matters. What I do in the classroom matters. Mm-hmm. And not that my mom didn't, you know, she wasn't like a hound. You know, I'm the type of person, I need you to hound me about it. I need you to get on me about it, especially at that age in my life. And he did.
You need discipline from someone who didn't love you.
Exactly. Exactly. I needed someone who wasn't my mother to say, you can be better than what you are.
Right.
And so once he did that and I realized it, I was like, that's why I got into coaching. I was like, I want to be this for somebody else. These kids need this.
Right.
I'm not the only kid sitting in a house without a dad. And I would say a lot of those addicts, I don't know about women, but because I'm a man, but a lot of those men addicts are probably sitting in the house without a dad. You know, all the guys that were on our staff, we're like family, you know, and like Jason is is like a brother dad to me. It's just, yeah. It was a dad. And then we've come to like where we're not closer in age, but we're closer in like coaching positions. So it's almost like a brother now. Mm-hmm. And Bo is definitely like a father, and Nick's like a brother, and all those guys are family.
Right.
And so it didn't take long for you to become family either. It, you know, really just sitting down and having a conversation like we're doing right now, I quickly realized, I was like, oh, this dude's in. You're in like Flynn. Yeah. Your
family now. I thoroughly enjoyed you guys accepting me. I think that coaching is probably the most demanding thing that you'll ever do and the most rewarding thing you could ever do.
It is. A lot of people don't understand the amount of time that goes into being a coach, you know.
And a lot of diplomacy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, my wife, luckily we got married after I was already a coach. So she kind of knew what she was getting into. But, you know, there's just, you spend all day Sunday there. Some people spend all day Saturday there breaking down film, and and you're not getting home till 8:00. And it's just hard, you know.
Well, but, you know, that's not so difficult now since they got Huddle.
Oh, and yeah. You do
a lot anywhere. At your house.
Yeah. So I want to start wrapping it up, and I got a few things that I'd like to make sure we hit on. And one is some people who don't suffer from addiction. What is something that you can say to them to help them?
Excuse me.
What is something that you can say to them to help them have a better understanding of addiction?
Addiction is a disease. It changes the personality of a person. It makes them do things that they swore that they would never do.
Mm-hmm.
It makes them do things that makes them ashamed of things that they did. And, you know, but you can't fix somebody's addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make someone go into treatment. You can't make anybody go into recovery. The only thing that you can do is that you can not help the person. You can't be an enabler. You give them a choice. I will not do this and not do it. But most people love the person that's in, that is got the disease of addiction. Mm-hmm. And when they stop using their drug of choice, and then they start having withdrawals and symptoms, the person doesn't want to see them hurt.
Right.
And so they will go in and, well, let me have this, let me have that.
Right.
You can encourage people past the pain. But if you were to provide money or provides a means for someone to continue their addiction,
you're enabling them.
Then you're enabling.
Right.
And that's not going to help them at all.
So what you're saying is basically, sometimes it's going to hurt. Sometimes it's going to be hard, but be there for them emotionally, but don't.
They've got to get to the end of the road by themselves.
Right.
But you can say, I will help you if you decide that you want to go into treatment.
Right.
I'll be glad to help you there.
Well, as we did in the last one, we're going to do in this one too. And we're going to make this the title of the episode. So I know you've had a nice long 2 weeks to think about this. What is something, another quote or mantra or thought process that you've lived your life by that's driven you in the direction that you've gone?
I've tried a lot of things in my life, and I have fortunately been able to succeed in some. I've failed more times than I've succeeded. That's life.
Mm-hmm.
You are. But the one thing I have learned in life is that hard work beats talent if talent doesn't work hard.
I like that. Basically ties right into your last one. I like that. Okay. Well, Rip, I have to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed this. And based on the feedback that I've gotten from episode one, everybody else enjoyed it as well. This has been super fun. It's been fantastic. And I feel like we probably haven't even tapped into like a drop of the bucket in your stories and the life that you've lived. But I thoroughly appreciate you sitting down and spending your time with me.
You're more than welcome, my friend. I love you dearly. You're just, you know, you and your wife and little Kennedy is very special to me and Lori and my family. And I hope you're successful here. You make it very easy for us to sit and talk.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate
and
that.
So I hope that I know who your next guest is. I'm not going to reveal that, but I guarantee you, if you're listening to this, you need to tune in to the next one.
I like that.
He is a doozy.
I like it. Well, thank you very much, brother. I love you very much. Thank you so much.
Love you too, brother.
Wow. What another amazing episode with Rip Cannell. I just can't say enough about how much I love him. I could listen to him talk all day long. He is full of wisdom. He has all these great, phenomenal stories. And that's what Tuck's Take is all about. Let me learn from what you've been through. Let us all hear what you've done so that we can maybe grow together. And he has taught me so much just in these two episodes. I love sitting down with Rip. He always teaches me so much about life because he's done it all. To listen to him and the stories he has right now on how he's trying to help people with addiction and the passion he has for that, it's amazing. And so I really enjoyed this, and I hope y'all enjoyed it too. And I hope y'all come back for the next episode. You need to come back for the next episode of Tuck's Take. We have a guest who played football at the University of Tennessee. He is a bad mother trucker. He looks like daggum Ronnie Coleman in person, I swear. The first time I met him, I was blown away. This is somebody you don't want to be on the bad end of, okay? And he's a local fireman. I'm not sure how you say that. He is a local fireman, and he is just an all-around amazing guy. He's mentored countless young men, and his name is Nate Middlebrooks. And if you want, shoot me some questions for Nate Middlebrooks. Anything you want to know about fire departments or the Chattanooga Fire Department or football at Tennessee. Okay? Whatever you got, shoot me some questions. You know, shoot me a video or whatever you want. Just, you know, a message, whatever. You can go to Tuck's Take Podcast on Facebook, or you can go to Tuck's Take on Instagram, or you can just shoot me an email at tuckstake.podcast@gmail.com. Shoot me your questions, shoot me your interesting things, or on a different note, if you just have a guest that you would think would be amazing on Tuck's Take, somebody who's lived an above average life, who's been through some crazy things, anything, somebody who you think would be an amazing guest on Tuck's Take, somebody who I need to hear their story, we need to hear their story, then please send them to me. Shoot me a direct message. Shoot me an email. Like I said, Tuck's Take Podcast on Facebook, Tuck's Take on Instagram, and tuckstake.podcast@gmail.com. That's me.